This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington, and it's time for the news roundup. We've been dealing with coronavirus for more than 6 months now, but questions about the independence of the CDC are swirling after reports that their coronavirus guidelines were altered for political reasons. How did that happen, and what's changed? It's wildfires to the west, hurricanes to the south, and a pandemic everywhere on the news roundup today, so let's dive in. Here to help us unpack the week's top headlines is Jane Costin. She's a senior politics reporter at Vox. Jane, always great to have you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us, Shane Harris, who covers intelligence and national security at The Washington Post. Shane, welcome back.
Hi, Jen. Good to be here.
And making his roundup debut is William Brangham. He's a correspondent with PBS NewsHour. William, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me, Jen. Great to be here.
So this week, CDC Director Robert Redfield made some recommendations that you could argue aren't controversial.
These face masks are the most important, powerful public health tool we have. And I will continue to appeal for all Americans, all individuals in our country, to embrace these face coverings. I've said it, if we did it for 6, 8, 10, 12 weeks, we'd bring this pandemic under control. These actually, we have clear scientific evidence, they work, and they are our best defense. I might even go so far as to say that this face mask is more guaranteed to protect me against COVID than when I take a COVID vaccine, because the immunogenicity may be 70%. And if I don't get an immune response, the vaccine's not going to protect me. This face mask will.
That was CDC Director Robert Redfield speaking to Congress on Wednesday. He also told them we'd likely see a COVID vaccine in 2021. Now, President Trump then pushed back on Redfield's statements, once again contradicting the advice of his own health officials when it comes to coronavirus. Jane, what happened here? What did the president take issue with?
So Trump said that, and I'll quote him here, I think he made a mistake. He said that it's just incorrect information. And the dissidence between the two appeared to be on the subject of vaccine timing and on the idea of masking would be a better strategy than a vaccine. I think because so much of the president's campaign on coronavirus focuses on the main point that he's been making since March, that this will all just go away. And the idea of a vaccine, and a vaccine that might arrive as soon as October, which would be extremely rapid timing due to the fact that it's September 18th and we need to get through a lot of testing on human subjects. I think that Trump has been leaning on the idea of a vaccine, even though vaccine uptake levels, based on current surveys, aren't very high.
Shane, when we hear this back and forth about a timeline for a coronavirus vaccine, how much does that shake the public's faith in the efficacy of a vaccine at all?
Well, I think it certainly shakes their faith in whether or not it's being rushed or properly put through its paces and tested. And we've already seen some polls that are really troubling, saying, you know, roughly half of Americans are reluctant to get the coronavirus vaccine. And I think the way that the White House and the administration are trying to rush this through is some kind of miracle cure that's going to happen before the end of the year plays into that. And these are, you know, headwinds, it's important to remember, of a kind that, you know, CDC and FDA officials and other career public health officials have been having to deal with since the pandemic began, when they're trying to, you know, correct the rhetoric and many of the misstatements that are coming out of the White House that are painting this more optimistically, and trying to level with the American people about the severity of the disease, how it spreads, and about the fact, as Dr. Redfield said, that it's just not likely that all of America is going to be vaccinated by the end of the year. That is almost certainly not going to happen.
William, what about face masks? This has become a political football. Why has this issue become so politicized?
I wish I had a good answer to that. And it's actually one of the most troubling things about this whole pandemic. And just as you said, what Redfield said before the Senate should be considered non-controversial or not even questioned by the science, that face masks work. I think part of the politicization has happened because there was this initial confusion about it. I mean, initially, from everyone from Anthony Fauci on down at the beginning of the pandemic indicated most Americans don't need to wear a face mask, only first-line healthcare providers and people like that. Then, as the science emerged that asymptomatic transmission was really occurring, that people who were not demonstrably sick could get other people sick, that was when it really changed. And so people came along saying, well, wait, you told me not to wear a mask. Now you're telling me to wear a mask. The president, as we've seen, has been very resistant to wearing one. I don't want to play armchair psychiatrist and try to understand why he and some of his supporters think of it as something that they don't want to do or that they resist. But the fact is that we've got a lot of people. We see these viral videos going on all over the country, people fighting against this, what is really a relatively minor yet life-saving inconvenience.
Well, speaking of the CDC, its scientists were accused of sedition by a top spokesman at the Department of Health and Human Services this week. Mark Caputo has taken a leave of absence after posting a conspiracy-filled live stream on his Facebook. Jane, who is Mark Caputo and what was in this live stream?
So he was head of communications for the Department of Health and Human Services and a longtime ally of the president, and then he posted a Facebook live stream in which he accused government scientists of sedition and warned of incoming violence from left-wing hit squads. He talked about the shadows on the wall and urged followers to buy ammunition because it's going to be hard to get, and said that the CDC had a resistance unit. And so his ousting actually comes at it's a long time coming, and I think there's been some really smart reporting by Politico to talk about Caputo's past. He was a confidant of Operative Roger Stone. He basically got this position because Trump approached him about the job, and it wasn't HHS Secretary Alex Azar. And so this was very much, he took a very political role. He wanted to change, and Trump very much wanted to change what the public was going to learn about coronavirus. And by doing so, he had a lot, Caputo put a lot of Trump-associated veterans and a lot of Trump-associated loyalists in charge of CDC and HHS outreach efforts rather than people with a focus on science. And so now Caputo has announced that he is taking a 60-day medical leave, and this has really showed how much the politicization of HHS and CDC has really, it's caused a lot of concern, not just for people observing, but for people working within these departments.
Shane, how did Facebook and Twitter handle this?
Well, they've had to come at this from, what they've done in the past with flagging this kind of material, and I think maybe in some cases even having to pull misleading content. The Facebook live stream, actually, I know some reporters that Caputo was doing had trouble actually getting to it. I'm not quite sure how many people it went out to, but I think that they've had to approach this in a similar way that they do when disinformation is tweeted or put out on Facebook posts by the president or misleading medical advice, which is to say that it doesn't meet their community standards, and they would have to come at it that way. I don't know how many people actually saw Caputo's Facebook live stream. Ultimately, reporters spotted it and brought it to people. But, it is another reminder of just how political this effort has become. I mean, Michael Caputo was best known before this as a sort of minor character in the Russia investigation. So to see him coming to HHS in this position when he has no background in public health, I think was a pretty obvious signal that the White House wanted to take political control of the CDC's messaging.
Well, William, of course, this comes in the wake of reports from Politico that HHS has been manipulating information on the pandemic for political reasons. Give us a quick rundown on the story there.
Yeah, what has been happening in the past is reporting has come out that HHS was trying to stop some of the information that the CDC was putting out. They put out these regular dispatches to the medical profession about the latest on the pandemic, what we've learned about transmission, and that there was an attempt to try to intercept those communications and to change them and to, in some cases, hold them up for long periods of time. There was one report that came out about them trying to stop, for a month, a report issued that was showing how hydroxychloroquine, which we know was a treatment that the president has long touted, that really showed no real efficacy in treating people who were infected with the virus. They tried to stop that from coming out for 4 weeks. And again, as Shane and Jane are saying, it's one more example of, and I think it feeds so much of this distrust that people are having, that can we really trust the information we're getting? And if people start to wonder, can I trust the CDC? Can I trust the FDA? What if a vaccine comes later this month or in November? It's the absolute worst thing you can have when you're trying to fight a virus, is people wondering every utterance from official, previously trusted government scientists.
Well, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has actually called for the resignation of HHS Secretary Alex Azar over these reports. Here's part of what he said on the floor of the Senate this week.
It has become abundantly clear that the leadership of the Department of Health and Human Services has allowed perhaps the most important federal agency right now to become subservient to the president's daily whims. So today, I am calling on Secretary Azar to resign immediately. We need a Secretary of Health and Human Services who will look out for the American people, not President Trump's political interests.
Jane, briefly, what's the likelihood that these calls for his resignation will go anywhere?
Very unlikely, given that we're just a couple of months, mere weeks before the election. But I do think that one of the challenges here is that we have an election taking place at the same time that we have a life-threatening and, for thousands of Americans, deadly pandemic. And so the politicization of these two bodies that are expected to keep America's public health safe in some way is a really massive challenge as we attempt to get towards vaccine testing.
We're discussing the week's top headlines with Jane Costin, senior politics reporter at Vox, Shane Harris, intelligence and national security reporter at The Washington Post, and William Brigham, correspondent with PBS NewsHour. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
Support for 1A and the following message come from Indeed. Indeed is here to help when small businesses have to be more efficient than ever, and every hire is critical. Indeed.com is the number one job site in the world because they get you the best people fast. You only pay for what you need, can pause your account at any time, and there are no long-term contracts. Try Indeed out with a free $75 credit at Indeed.com/1A. Terms and conditions apply. Offer valid through September 30th.
Did you know that NPR has a Spanish language podcast? It's called Radio Ambulante. We tell the stories and make Latin America come to life. Amazing, unexpected stories, like lost gold in the Caribbean, or playtime under quarantine, or a life rediscovered after a bout of amnesia. Our new season has it all. New episodes every Tuesday starting September 15th. Listen now to the Radio Ambulante podcast from NPR.
I'm Jen White, and it's the News Roundup on 1A. We're wrapping up the biggest stories across America this week with Jane Costin, senior politics reporter at Vox, Shane Harris, intelligence and national security reporter at The Washington Post, and William Brigham, correspondent with PBS NewsHour. Well, much of the country was blanketed by a haze of smoke this week from the West Coast fires. Meanwhile, another deadly hurricane is causing major flooding along the Gulf Coast. And experts agree that climate change is to blame for the dramatic weather patterns. Wade Crowfoot, he's California Secretary for Natural Resources, laid it out in a meeting with President Trump on Monday.
We've had temperatures explode this summer. You may have learned that we broke a world record in the Death Valley, 130 degrees. But even in greater LA, 120 plus degrees. And we're seeing this warming trend make our summers warmer, but also our winters warmer as well. So I think one area of mutual agreement and priority is vegetation management. But I think we want to work with you to really recognize the changing climate and what it means to our forests, and actually work together with that science. That science is going to be key, because if we ignore that science and sort of put our head in the sand and think it's all about vegetation management, we're not going to succeed together protecting Californians.
Okay. It'll start getting cooler.
You just watch. I wish science agreed with you.
That was California's Secretary for Natural Resources, Wade Crowfoot, trying to convince President Trump to accept the realities of climate change. Shane, what are your takeaways from this visit?
Well, I thought that exchange was actually such a perfect encapsulation of the way that the president has continued to resist the idea that there is a scientific consensus around climate change or global warming. I mean, there is. It's not something that is, you know, broadly speaking, opposed by the business community, the scientific community. It's something that there's a lot of embrace of. And frankly, corporations, even in the energy sector, are making plans to try and transition in the long term away from fossil fuels and to recognize that this is where policy is moving in the country. But it's also an important reminder that when the president resists that and tries to say the opposite is true, or don't worry, it'll be fine, it'll just go away, which is, again, rhetoric we're used to hearing in the pandemic, it makes it very hard to mobilize any kind of federal response. And so much of, in the case of California with these wildfires, as Governor Newsom pointed out in the subsequent exchange, this is federal land, a lot of it. So the federal government has to become a partner in helping to control not just this fire, but to mitigate and prevent future fires. And when, you know, the chief executive is not on board with that idea and thinks you can just ignore it, I think it underscores how very hard it's going to be for the state of California going forward.
Well, in a speech on Monday, Democratic nominee Joe Biden called Trump a, quote, climate arsonist for his response to the wildfires. Jane, to what extent is climate change a defining issue in this presidential race?
Well, I think that it is an undercurrent of this presidential race, but I think it's particularly challenging here because the assumption, when I talk to conservatives about this issue, it's interesting because Trump doesn't want to acknowledge any of this at all because it'll just get cooler, just like how coronavirus will just go away. But the presumption again then is, okay, climate change is real. What do we do about it? And so with regard to the wildfires, across 12 states, there's been more than 4.6 million acres burned. And there are these massive fires taking place. But I think that there's also an understanding that in some way this is state government fault, a state government's fault. In some way, this is something that the federal government doesn't need to handle. And more critically, the federal government doesn't need to spend money on. So I think that this is a defining issue for a lot of people. But I also think that there is a very heavy impetus on behalf of corporate interests, on behalf of kind of the heavy-handed elites of some kind, to argue that actually real Americans don't care about this. This isn't a kitchen table issue, when if you can't be at your kitchen table because it's burned down, it's a pretty big issue.
William, your thoughts as you're watching this campaign play out, how much is climate change playing into the race?
Well, to Jane's point, I think, and again, we see this similarly happening with the pandemic, is a partisan divide over an issue, how we respond to that issue. I mean, I think the polling, especially during the Democratic presidential primary, showed that climate change was a fairly big issue for a lot of Democratic voters. As Jane was saying, it's certainly not an issue nearly as much for Republican voters. And so whether the president is echoing his base, I mean, we know that for years, even before he had a run for office, he believed that climate change was a hoax. And since he came into office, he spent a good chunk of his time undoing the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan, pulling out of the Paris Accords, dialing back auto emissions and coal plant rules. Those are very much in line with what his base seems to believe, and it does seem to be what the president believes as well. Democrats, again, firmly believe this is an issue. Joe Biden has moved in many ways more to the left than a lot of climate activists had originally expected from him. They thought he would be somewhat temperate and moderate. He gave a fairly, according to activists, progressive climate speech this week and called for a fair amount of bold action. So again, I think it's a distressing thing for the country when we have such a clear cleavage between the Democrats and the Republicans over an issue that, as Shane was saying, there's not that much contention about the science behind it. What we do about that is, of course, a different issue. How we respond, whether that will have an impact, those are big issues to debate. But the facts here are the facts.
Jane, is this a place where we're seeing a generational divide across parties?
I think so to some degree, but I would also say that I think that one of the challenges here is that there are a lot of people who can make a great deal of profit out of not paying attention to this issue and not dealing with this issue in a way that is truly important. And NPR did really terrific reporting this week, following up on reporting that's been done over the last 20 years, showing that the oil industry was well aware that plastic recycling was not as effective as it kept telling people it was, but they wanted to keep producing plastics because you can make plastics out of, you guessed it, oil. And so I think that there's a lot of corporate interest here, despite the fact that I think people of all age ranges are concerned about climate change, especially when climate change is the reason why in Washington, D.C., the sunset looks red because of the smoke in the air that's coming from Oregon and Washington.
Well, undecided voters in Pennsylvania had the opportunity to ask President Trump questions this week during an ABC town hall in Philadelphia. And here's some of what they said.
Why did you throw vulnerable people like me under the bus?
Why don't you support a mandate for national mask wearing? And why don't you wear a mask more often?
Why would you downplay a pandemic that is known to disproportionately harm low-income families and minority communities?
Jane, sum up this town hall for us. What happened?
So I think that the ABC town hall, it was a big challenge for the president because on the one hand, National Review had a pretty solid write-up from a conservative perspective saying that Trump seemed to acquiesce to a lot of the questioning, but on every single question about coronavirus, he fumbled. For instance, there was a questioner who talked about how she had lost a relative to cancer, and somehow Trump took that to mean coronavirus and started talking about coronavirus again. And so I think that this was a particular challenge because this was some of the first times in which Trump had faced really direct questioning from the public on these particular issues and not direct questioning coming from, say, Sean Hannity. And so I think that this showed that Trump's strategy over the past couple of months has been really one aimed at the base, even advertising extremely heavily on Fox News, a Fox News that Trump himself watches. And so I think that the aim there and this town hall showed that when you are playing towards a base strategy, it's really hard to get undecided voters, even those who may have leaned towards you back in 2016.
Shane, the Washington Post fact checker, gave Trump four Pinocchios for his performance at this town hall, which means some big time falsehoods were flying around. Any examples?
Well, of course, he was challenged on health care and said he's not trying to strip, you know, pre-existing conditions. And I think tried to even claim some credit for Obamacare in the first place. He said that he had fired Jim Mattis, the Secretary of Defense. He didn't. He claimed that Winston Churchill was misleading the British people about the Blitz. That's not true. Winston Churchill famously leveled with the British people about the severity of the war that they were facing with Germany. And I think, you know, importantly, we're getting a preview of what it's going to be like in the presidential debates when he does have to face, you know, argumentative moderators. He has to face Joe Biden. And there's going to be a town hall debate as well. Now, to Jane's point, the president is not used to hearing from people who disagree with him. And he's not used to being challenged in private, certainly not on national television. And I think we're getting a sense of how he's going to handle that when we actually go into a debate with his opponent. And there's a town hall format as well. I don't imagine that the president is going to be less loose in his characterizations or adhere more to fact-checking, and for our understanding from reporting is that he's not really practicing for the debate either. So I think what we saw in Philadelphia is a pretty good preview of what we're going to see in the coming weeks.
Well, William, in looking at some of the chatter around this town hall, there were lots of people expressing surprise that there were still undecided voters. What do we know about how the polls are looking right now in terms of people who still haven't made up their minds?
You know, it's one of those things you hear, one of the axioms of politics, that if you're undecided at this point in a campaign, we just don't know what to do with you. And frankly, I do find it sometimes hard to understand, given how much attention the news with the pandemic and the wildfires and the hurricanes and just the incredible amount of attention that we spend on President Trump and everything he says. It is still surprising to me, frankly, that there are people who are not sure one way or the other. I mean, I think sometimes those of us who study politics and stay focused on this, we do marinate in it too much. And then you go out in the real world and you brush up against someone and they're like, you know what, I didn't, what do you mean? What did he say at that ABC town hall? They didn't even watch it. They're not on Twitter. They're not following it. So I do think we overestimate sometimes how much people are up against all of this. But again, the way we have sequestered ourselves in our media bubbles, in our social media bubbles, I think that contributes to this. I think people were really looking at this town hall and thinking, well, surely this will move people. I think people saw that former aide of Vice President Pence come out in that advertisement last night and really blast the president for his coronavirus response. Again, I'm not sure that those things filter out universally the way that they used to. And so the things that some people might look at as earth-shaking and clearly this will move the needle, I'm just not sure how much those things happen nowadays.
New polling shows President Trump gaining popularity in the battleground state of Florida. Joe Biden made his first visit to the state this week since securing the Democratic presidential nomination. Now, Jay, new polling shows that Cuban Americans in Miami who voted for Obama aren't sold on Biden. What's happening?
So I think that Cuban Americans tend to be more socially and politically conservative than other groups. And so But I also think it's important to note that among Latinos, just among African Americans, there's also a pronounced gender gap in terms of voting. So a lot of the rise in Latinos voting for Trump has taken place among Latino men. And you see the same thing among Black Americans. So exit polling shows from the 2016 election shows that 13% of Black men voted for Donald Trump, 4% of Black women did. And in a state like Pennsylvania, which is very critical, that number dropped to 1%. So I think it's really interesting because I think sometimes we think of African Americans or Latinos as, or Asian Americans for that matter, as an amorphous group on, that could have a leadership or a community, when we're actually talking about people who came, who may have emigrated to this country decades ago or a couple of weeks ago, people whose experiences of the American dream have been very different, you know, depending on whether or not you came from Guatemala or Mexico or Cuba, for example. So I think it's important to think about these numbers in the context in which they exist. You have a Cuban American population that already tends to think and vote pretty conservatively.
Well, Biden went viral in a video of him playing the popular song Despacito on his phone at the event in Florida. Then President Trump tweeted an altered version of the video with the NWA song F the Police dubbed in. William, what happened here and how did Twitter respond?
Again, for people who are not familiar with what happened here, Biden played this song. The songwriter who wrote Despacito was going about to come out, and so Biden was trying to do this to show that he was sort of hip, and the way he fumbled with his phone was kind of endearing. The fake video version of that made it seem as if Biden was actually playing, as you were saying, this NWA song that is much more harsh about the police. And again, as Shane was saying with what happened with the Michael Caputo video, Twitter and Facebook, as soon as they become alerted to these things, they try to either tag them or pull them down. But as we have seen constantly, and I think this is going to be something that all of us journalists have to be on top of as we get closer to the election, is this fear that these sorts of things, which are so easily made and so easily transmittable, that you can completely change the impression of an event with one of these videos. And Twitter and Facebook, for as much as they say they are trying to clamp down on these things, put warning signs on these things, or just pull them offline completely, we've seen time and time again where these things can be copied, replicated, altered ever so slightly so that they can keep passing through these filters. I mean, it's something that terrifies me as a journalist. I look at things sometimes, I think, surely that is that person who is saying that fact. And then I have to stop and check myself. Well, how do I know that really is what it purports to be? And again, not everyone out there in the world cares about fact-checking. You see something exciting on Twitter, it's hard not to retweet it. There's a whole endorphin rush in that process, and we as a nation have to wrestle with this. It's a real problem, as easy as the technology is to fake these things.
Well, Shane, disinformation and conspiracy theories are flooding Latino communities in Florida through WhatsApp, Facebook, and the radio. What are these messages focused on, and do we know where they're coming from?
Well, we've seen a lot, frankly, of disinformation around the pandemic, certainly. And I think a lot of that has been coming, frankly, from the president himself. Interestingly, the Homeland Security Department came out recently saying that Russian media were trying to infiltrate social media in the U.S., trying to discourage people from mail-in voting, that this was something that they had actually come out and started attacking. And again, echoing some of the things that the president has said, that mail-in voting is not secure. I think, interestingly, when Donald Trump was retweeting this doctored image from Joe Biden, he was also playing on something of a bit of propaganda here, which is this idea that Joe Biden supports defunding the police or dismantling police departments, which you might get the impression of if you thought he actually was playing this NWA song from the 80s. But of course, that's not true. And he's given speeches about this and said that's not what he supports. So, you know, I think this underscores, too, just how high the stakes are in Florida and the extent to which the, you know, the Latino voting population there could make or break it for one candidate or another. I mean, you're talking about whisker-thin margins in most of the last six or so, at least, presidential races, and Trump narrowly won that state in 16. So the stakes could not be higher right now.
That's Shane Harris, intelligence and national security reporter at The Washington Post. Also with us, William Brangham, correspondent with PBS NewsHour, and Jane Costin, senior politics reporter at Vox. We're discussing the week's top headlines with our guests and with you. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more in a moment.
I'm Gregory Warner with NPR's Rough Translation. How a pop star in China sparked an online war over the right to fantasize.
Even just like writing about your favorite couple having sex.
Fighting for the freedom to dream in China. That's on NPR's Rough Translation.
Let's get back to our news roundup with Jane Costin, senior politics reporter at Vox, Shane Harris, intelligence and national security reporter at The Washington Post, and William Brangham, correspondent with PBS NewsHour. A nurse working at an ICE detention center in Georgia has accused the agency of performing unnecessary hysterectomies on immigrant women. This is part of a whistleblower complaint filed on Monday. The Department of Homeland Security opened an investigation into the allegations on Wednesday. Jane, there were some disturbing allegations here. What can you tell us about them?
Yes, the allegations were extraordinarily disturbing, and this took place at the Irwin County Detention Center in Ocilla, Georgia. And the doctor in the case, Dr. Mahendra Amin, who had a previous experience with federal prosecutors, he agreed to a $520,000 settlement regarding committing massive Medicaid fraud, in which he basically gave patients unnecessary procedures in order to bolster Medicare checks going to the hospital where he worked. He was accused of a whistleblower of essentially giving people forcible hysterectomies. I'll quote here, everybody he sees has a hysterectomy, just about everybody. He's even take out the wrong ovary on a young lady. She was supposed to get her left ovary removed because of the cyst in the left ovary. He took out the right one. And she added, everybody's uterus cannot be that bad, and said that this center was like an experimental concentration camp. And so the allegations obviously are still being investigated. ICE said that they vehemently dispute the implication that detainees are used for experimental medical procedures, but there is a continuing investigation taking place.
Well, this whistleblower also expressed concerns about COVID-19 testing and protection for workers.
Yeah, and so I think that one of the things here is that one of the challenges that we've seen is that if you think that coronavirus testing and coronavirus protections are bad in, you know, in private spaces, in ICE detention, in prisons, we've seen massive numbers of cases. In fact, in part why the wildfires in California and elsewhere are so bad is because the prison labor that are typically used to fight wildfires are too sick with coronavirus to go do so. And so the whistleblower raised a lot of concerns about the lack of protections and the lack of available PPE.
What do we expect to come out of this DHS investigation, Jane?
It's unclear. I think that this investigation, over 170 members of Congress signed a letter demanding an investigation into this. And so, and Amin for himself has denied the allegations. But I think that it's unclear of whether or not we're going to, one, see any sort of resolution to this investigation by the end of the year. But also, this raises a lot of questions about the doctors being used at other ICE detention facilities and detention facilities across the country. I think that for so many people, detention facilities, prisons, jails are kind of, and the people within them are largely ignored. But it's also worth noting here that ICE detention, people are being kept there for months, sometimes years at a time, and this is the type of medical care that they might be receiving.
Well, we'll talk more about this investigation and take a look at how ICE detention centers have handled COVID early next week. But Jane, activists have been calling for the abolishment of ICE since this administration took office. Where does that movement stand?
I think that the abolish ICE movement, it got a lot of attention a couple of years ago. But I think that, you know, there are a lot of people who are still very focused on it. Whether or not it will have political effectiveness, I think that remains to be seen. I think that one of the challenges here is that we have both the moral imperative of the people who believe that ICE should be abolished and the people who will recognize that whether or not abolish ICE is an effective political message. And so you saw saw an effort to downplay that during the 2018 midterms by Democrats, with the real emphasis on attempting to win back suburbanites and people who might not be as radicals wanting to abolish ICE, to abolish, I mean, I would argue that a department of the government that was formed, you know, well after I was in grade school, perhaps is lax necessity. But I think that for a lot of people, there is a real effort that abolish ICE, we understand this, the impetus behind this movement, but politically, it's more important for us to focus on getting Trump out of office.
Well, turning from ICE to the protests, Attorney General William Barr has told federal prosecutors to consider charging those who commit violent crime at protests with sedition. Reports also say he asked Justice Department prosecutors about bringing criminal charges against Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkan. The DOJ has denied those reports. Shane, what's the significance of the U.S. Attorney General suggesting that rioters be charged with sedition?
Well, first of all, they're people who are arguably exercising their First Amendment rights. And, you know, there are crimes against property destruction that would presumably cover people who go from peaceful protests to rioting or to looting. So to hear him invoke, you know, something like sedition, which we think of, you know, sort of in a much more historical context of, you know, betraying the country or mounting insurrection, gives, I think, a look into how the Attorney General has been seeing these protests. And he doesn't view them as, you know, kind of an organic, if you will, welling up of broad public support against police violence or against racial injustice or inequities, but rather as movements that are being manipulated by far-left agitators, by groups that he will sort of categorize as Antifa. And his approach seems to be not trying to deal with these as police actions, but rather to try and pinpoint them as some kind of political insurgency or movement, the way you would think of like a rebellion. So it's really a view into, I think, the peculiar lens through which the Attorney General is viewing this. But he is the Attorney General. He can direct, you know, U.S. attorneys' offices to pursue prosecutions. He gets to set that tone. It's very much in line with the president's as well. And I would note that he gave a speech on Wednesday at Hillsdale College here in Washington, in which he talked a lot about some of his well-documented views that there should be more political control of prosecutorial decisions. Traditionally, in the Justice Department, we see the Attorney General carrying out the policies of an administration, but really leaving the decision on when to bring charges and how to do that much more to the discretion of independent prosecutors. And Bill Barr has essentially said, I don't think we should do things that way. And that's a view he's held for a long time.
Well, what do we know about the response from those DOJ prosecutors Barr brought this suggestion to?
Well, I think you're going to see a lot of pushback from it. And I think that U.S. attorneys also view themselves as both independent, but also recognizing that we're in the midst of an election here. And if, you know, Joe Biden becomes the president, presumably a lot of those U.S. attorneys are going to be out of a job, you know, maybe out of a job, or there'll be new appointees coming in. You know, the career people at the Justice Department, and certainly people who I've talked to, just don't have the view of the same way that the Attorney General does, a feeling that this is an appropriate place to exercise this kind of political control. There was a former U.S. attorney, Chuck Rosenberg, who said that, you know, the idea that he would, that the Justice Department would prosecute the mayor of Seattle seems to reflect some personal offense that the Attorney General was taking at the idea that there would be this autonomous protest zone that was started up. So I don't think that this is really a view that career prosecutors and line attorneys at the department are going to agree with.
And just put this into context for us, William, when we think of how the U.S. Attorney General has typically performed those duties, how does this line up?
Well, I think, as Shane was saying, what we're seeing here, and this is this sort of what many critics would argue is the weaponization of the DOJ, is in some ways what President Trump expressed such great disappointment with Jeff Sessions, that Jeff Sessions wasn't more an attorney general who was in his camp and looking out for him and doing the things that he wanted to see done. And in some ways, Bill Barr has stepped into that role. I mean, just as Shane was saying, his view of the Black Lives Matter movement is not that it is representative of true distress at the way in which African Americans are disproportionately shot and killed by the police, that it's not something real, that it is simply a manufactured crisis. That is exactly the same kind of thing we hear coming out of the president's mouth. And so, again, we saw in other cases where Bill Barr stepped in with regards to Roger Stone, with regards to Michael Flynn, and stepped in and interfered in the prosecutorial recommendations of those prosecutors on those cases. We saw several defections of prosecutors on those cases stepping away and saying tacitly, if you're going to come and do this, we're off this case. So again, many people who look at this and think this is a really a troubling instance, especially when we could have a contested election, long time to count all of these mail-in votes that might be coming in November. What role will the Department of Justice play in that process if we have an attorney general who seems to so closely dovetail with the political orientation of the president?
Well, Jane, and how much concern is there around this idea that this could mark a shift in the way the DOJ performs and the way the attorney general, despite who's in office, the way they approach their duties?
Well, I actually would argue that in some ways this is not much of a shift at all. If you recall, during the civil rights movement in the mid-1960s, there was a view that the civil rights protesters were being used by some sort of force above them, whether or not it was communism or some other force, because the general idea here is that people protesting in favor of the Black Lives Matter movement don't know what they're really doing, which I think is an implication that implies everyone involved is an idiot. And so I think that one of the challenges here is that we've heard a lot of talk from this administration about criminal justice reform, but without the effort to eliminate qualified immunity, for example, and with a lot of mouth speak about law and order, however law and order might not apply to Trump appointees or to Trump's friends, I think in some ways you aren't going to see very much of a shift at all. You are still going to see a real use of heavy penalties and a real use of the threat of federal action and the use of sedition as being it reminds me of the Alien and Sedition Act. And so I think that this in some ways is a shift vocally, but it's again a base play. This is aimed at people who are fervently in the belief that New York and DC are riven with crime, and also of the belief that criminal justice reform only benefits people who are committing crimes, which couldn't possibly be them. And I do think it's interesting that news just broke that former Full House star Lori Loughlin just received permission from a federal judge to serve her prison sentence at a facility of her choice, because it's very clear that criminal justice reform is for some and law and order is for others.
Well, in June, law enforcement forcibly cleared D.C. protesters from Lafayette Square. Now a whistleblower says federal officials had started stockpiling ammunition and other devices to use against protesters there. Shane, break this down for us. What are the implications here?
Well, these allegations come from D.C. National Guard Major Adam DeMarco, who I believe was the senior guard person on the scene there, of course, when the president went across the street for the photo op with the Bible and protesters were forcibly removed. He said that there was not only ammunition being stockpiled, but that there was an investigation or an examination of whether the guard could use a heat ray weapon, as it was described. This is actually a military weapon that uses energy pulses to make it feel like people's skin is burning, and it's been kind of looked at as a possible crowd control mechanism before, never in the context that I'm aware of in a domestic protest like this. So what we're seeing here is a real kind of bringing of military force to what had been, I think, by all accounts, and we've looked at this very closely at the Post, peaceful protests. We saw examples of, helicopters buzzing over crowds. We had, of course, the tear gas. We had other kind of combat-style tactics. There were inquiries of whether or not Customs and Border Patrol could bring helicopters with zip lines down to the scene, which made it sound like the White House and the view of Secret Service anyway was somehow going to be under attack. These are just tactics that we're not used to seeing in the context of a peaceful protest in the United States. And I think, again, just underscores, what a departure that event there at the White House in the summer was from normally how law enforcement deals with people exercising their rights to free speech and assembly.
And quickly, how does what Major DeMarco is saying differ from what the administration has said about the force used to clear protesters?
He's contradicting administration claims that there was, you know, violence or tear gas that was used, and essentially, you know, kind of giving the lie to this idea as well that the protesters were offered multiple chances to leave and that they were warned. And I think press accounts have backed him up on that. But the fact that he is saying this in testimony to Congress as a sort of senior official is really extraordinary, I think.
Well, let's wrap on some news from the Federal Reserve. It announced on Wednesday that it's planning to leave interest rates near zero until at least 2023.
With regard to interest rates, we now indicate that we expect it will be appropriate to maintain the current 0 to 1/4% target range for the federal funds rate until labor market conditions have reached levels consistent with the committee's assessments of maximum employment and inflation has risen to 2% and is on track to moderately exceed 2% for some time.
That was Fed Chair Jerome Powell speaking at a news conference on Wednesday. William, what is Powell saying here? What does keeping interest rates this low mean for the economy?
Well, I mean, in some ways, it's a pretty unprecedented thing to hear the Fed chief say, we're not going to raise rates for years downstream. I mean, the shift here is that it's basically saying goodbye to this longstanding practice where the Fed would lift interest rates to try to preemptively head off inflation. Now it's saying we don't expect to see inflation for till 2023, and it's going to keep rates near zero even after they start to see that. So, again, it's low interest rates for a long time into the future, good for people who want to be borrowing a lot of money. It's also really, I think, an acknowledgement that they're trying to put job growth as the priority. It's a sort of recognition of what the pandemic has done to this economy and to the number of people in this country who are unemployed and suffering because of it. And so, you know, a lot of analysts who are looking at this say this is a really ambitious change up to their policy setting goals.
That's William Brangham, a correspondent with PBS NewsHour. Also with us, Shane Harris, covers intelligence and national security at The Washington Post, and Jane Costin, senior politics reporter at Fox. Thanks to you all. 1A's lead audio engineer and sound designer is Jake Cheery. He gets technical assistance from Ben Privett, Mike Kidd, and Rashad Young. Aileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. Gabrielle Healy is our digital editor, and Chris Castano is our digital producer. Stay with us for our international section of our news roundup right after this. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
This is 1A, and it's time now to turn to the international edition of the News Roundup. It's our time to go global and catch up on what's been going on overseas. Around the world, the number of people diagnosed with COVID-19 tops 30 million. Israel becomes the first country to enter a second lockdown as concerns grow that the UK might be about to do the same. And in the Far East, Taiwan says it's had to scramble fighter jets to track approaching Chinese aircraft crossing Taiwan Strait, a sign of escalating tensions between the two nations. Our guests this week are Nancy Youssef, a national security reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Nancy, it's great to have you back.
Great to be with you.
Paul Danahar is Washington Bureau Chief for the BBC and author of The New Middle East, The World After the Arab Spring. Paul, thanks for coming back.
Thank you very much.
And also with us, Hayes Brown. He's the host of the podcast News O'Clock at BuzzFeed. Hayes, it's great to have you back on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's start our global look at the news this week on the South Lawn of the White House.
This day is a pivot of history. I am grateful to you, President Trump. You have boldly confronted the tyrants of Tehran. You've proposed a realistic vision for peace, and you have successfully brokered the historic peace that we are signing today, a peace that has broad support in Israel, in America, in the Middle East, indeed, in the entire world.
Benjamin Netanyahu speaking there. Paul, a peace deal infers that at some point there had been a war, but that's not the case here. So what can you tell us about what's officially known as the Abraham Accord?
Yeah, absolutely right. There was no war to end. So this is basically a normalization, and it's a deal that makes absolutely everybody happy, apart from Iran and the Palestinians. This is basically lifting from beneath the table what's been going on for years and saying we're all friends, because there have been links, and very close links, between Israel and the UAE and Bahrain in terms of trade, in terms of cooperation, trying to basically contain Iran. So they've basically done what everyone's known they've been doing, but done it out in the open. And it's an important move, you know, in the sense that it has brought Israel back or more into the fold in the Arab world. And it's kind of basically said, this is what we're doing now. It's all out in the open. But it's not the deal of the century that the president promised at the beginning. It again leaves the Palestinians out in the cold. So it's a step forward, I think, for many people in the Middle East, but it's a step backwards for the Palestinians.
Well, Jared Kushner told reporters that everybody wrote off the Trump administration's chances in the Middle East. How significant is this for the Trump administration?
I think it's a big deal for them in the sense that this is their most this is their biggest diplomatic achievement. I would say their biggest foreign policy achievement was probably dismantling ISIS. But this is unquestionably their biggest diplomatic achievement. And I think they can pat themselves on the back. But to be honest with you, it was a deal that pretty much everybody involved wanted to be made. What I think is interesting is the addition of Bahrain at the end, because that's an indication that Saudi Arabia is thinking about moving itself. Bahrain doesn't do anything without the permission, basically, of Saudi Arabia. So I don't think Saudi Arabia will do anything before the election. But if Trump gets back in again, there is a reasonable chance that Saudi Arabia may follow suit.
Well, the Palestinians describe this agreement with UAE and Bahrain as a betrayal. Nancy, going forward, what's the likelihood of other Arab countries signing similar agreements?
Well, the Trump administration has signaled that five or six other countries are interested, but they have not named what those are. So far, indicators suggest that Oman and Sudan might be among those willing to sign on. But as Paul notes, I think the most important one going forward would be Saudi Arabia in terms of impact on the region and really signifying formally a Middle East that is no longer frozen in terms around the Palestinian issue in terms of how it deals with Israel, but rather pivoted towards emerging threats from Iran. And because remember, the 2002 Saudi-led Arab Peace Initiative had said that there should not be any kind of agreements like these without the recognition or dealing with the Palestinian issue. And the fact that the UAE and Bahrain move forward open the door, arguably, for other countries to do so. And again, moving away from the Palestinian issue as the primary one towards the Iranian threat.
Well, we spoke to Israel's senior advisor to the prime minister this week, and Mark Regev told me that we should start thinking about a wider peace as between Israel, the Arab world, and the Palestinians, not Israel, the Palestinians, and the Arab world. Is that shift underway?
I think in some ways, because the thing that the Palestinians were counting on was a united Arab voice in terms of dealing with issues. In this deal, for example, we saw Israel agree to halt its annexation of Palestinian territories, but it didn't say how long. And so the issues that are so important to the Palestinians in this deal were sort of an afterthought. They were mentioned only briefly in the ceremony that we saw on the White House lawn. And so if up until this point there hasn't been an ability to kind of get a solidified position around the Palestinian issue, it certainly seems much harder to do so as each country sort of breaks away, looks at its own interests. I mean, there are practical things we're going to see going forward with this deal. For example, the UAE and Bahrain are going to start having tourism and travel between the two countries. We'll see embassies. The more that normalization happens, it seems less likely that you're going to see a solidified Arab position on reconciling these longstanding issues vis-a-vis the Palestinians.
Hayes, step away from the hyperbole. What difference do you think this will make in the region?
So in the region, I'm not really sure is the thing. I think that as my colleagues have been saying, it really depends on Saudi Arabia and whether they are willing to take this next step. I mean, in the region, we'll see money flowing into Israel, into the UAE, as, you know, those trade ties increase. We'll see more tourism, as Nancy just said. But as far as these long-standing issues dealing with terror, I mean, just this week, Israel bombed Gaza because of rockets that were fired into Israel from that territory. So the deal that was signed on the White House lawn does not affect Israeli security in that regard. And as far as the region more broadly, as long as I think this is simmering on the back burner, I don't see it being something that just kind of magically goes away. I don't see there being a situation where the Palestinian people just completely give up, at least not in the extremely near term.
Well, we got this question from Jean, who asks, any thoughts on how Israel, beginning a three-week lockdown today, officially chose to meet and greet with its new treaty partners early this week? The use of the White House, I think she's referring to there. Nancy, your thoughts?
Well, that's a very good question, because there was quite a bit of consternation within Israel that Benjamin Netanyahu was willing to travel outside of the country in light of this lockdown. And I think one of the things that people took from this process is that there was a huge domestic benefit for Netanyahu. Not only is he battling the COVID epidemic there and the second national lockdown, which is creating great economic strain, but he's also battling federal corruption charges. And so I think this gave a domestic sort of slant in terms of how some saw the decision to do this deal at this time. I think so many think of this as the head of the U.S. presidential elections, but there were domestic politics at play as well within Israel, some would argue.
Well, President Donald Trump revealed Tuesday that he wanted to assassinate Syrian President Bashar Assad earlier in his presidency, reversing his previous denial that the issue ever came up. Here's how that came to light after a question from Brian Kilmeade to the president on Fox and Friends.
Is it true that after Assad gassed children for the second time, that it was you that wanted to take out Assad, that you had a good sight on him, and that it was General Mattis who talked you out of it? And if it is true, do you regret not taking him out?
I would have rather taken him out. I had him all set. Mattis didn't want to do it. Mattis was a highly overrated general.
So do you regret not taking out Assad?
No, I don't regret that. I could have lived either way with that.
Paul, the story has changed a number of times. What rationale do you think there might have been for not going after Assad? Because after all, he did go after Baghdadi and General Soleimani.
Yeah, but the Russians were behind Assad. And so to have killed Assad would have dragged him into a massive row with Russia. No one was really complaining in the West or in Russia or anywhere else about the killing of the other two men that you mentioned. But killing Assad would have been stepping things up. And at that time, Trump was kind of still getting his head around how to manage the Middle East and what he wanted to do and where he wanted to commit himself. And if he'd have bombed Assad and killed him, there was a risk that America would have got dragged deeper into the Syrian conflict. And this is a president that has made a big deal out of not getting America into wars, but pulling America out of them. And so I think he allowed himself to be persuaded otherwise by Mattis, and he never returned to it after Mattis was gone. So I suspect, you know, despite the bluster, he's quite happy with the decision because it allows him to say, I have disengaged America from conflict.
You know, Nancy, I'm curious how much the pandemic is sort of obliterating the attention that often gets paid to foreign policy and foreign policy achievements ahead of Election Day here in the U.S.
It's so interesting that you bring that up, because I think some were talking about the deal that we were just discussing on the White House lawn as something that would help the Trump presidency in the election. And yet one gets the sense that foreign policy is so far down in terms of the list of priorities. And so when we discuss issues, it's kind of extraordinary, right, that the U.S. talked about potentially assassinating a leader of another country after doing what were very provocative strikes at the time. I should note, I covered those strikes in 2017, and Hayes was my editor, so it all comes full circle. And so I think you get at a very important point that the coronavirus pandemic has so dominated, rightly so, the issues of the day, that we're less than 2 months away from the election, and I'm a national security correspondent who can't tell you with great detail what Trump's foreign policy vision is going forward, or Biden's for that matter, because it has been such an afterthought as we discuss presidential politics.
A survey released Wednesday showed that a shocking number of young adults in America lack basic knowledge of the Holocaust. The study was commissioned by the Conference on Jewish Material Claims Against Germany. Adults aged 18 to 39 across all 50 states were questioned, and 23% of respondents said they believed the Holocaust was a myth or had been exaggerated or they weren't sure. Nancy, 59% of respondents said they believe something like the Holocaust could happen again. Is that a sign of our times or a reflection of our current political climate?
I think it's that, and I think it's also the lack of understanding of what happened and the circumstances that led to it. As you point out in that survey, nationally, 63%, according to the survey, didn't know that 6 million Jews were killed in the Holocaust. And so what I found interesting in the survey is that so many people had gotten their understanding in social media or distortions of the Holocaust through social media. So I think it speaks to how information is conveyed. And I was thinking about it, and I don't mean to age myself, but when I was in school, when we would talk about the Holocaust, so often you would talk about survivors in your own communities. And I'm struck by the fact that we're now entering a period where that's less and less likely to be the case. And how do we treat history? How do we treat recent history in the age of social media and polarization and the absence of sort of that firsthand connection that I grew up with when I learned about the Holocaust? And so I think it's all the things you mentioned. It's how we treat history and how much I think so often one thinks of sort of these things as atrocities that could be repeated because of the tensions we're in, but not properly understanding why.
Well, 19% of the respondents in New York State said they felt the Jews caused the Holocaust. New York has the highest Jewish population of any state in the U.S. Hayes, what does that tell you about anti-Semitism there?
I mean, it tells me a couple of things. First of all, that anti-Semitism is alive and well, which is something that we've known. There's been a resurgence of it since 2017, according to many surveys and crime statistics. But I also want to... The methodology of the survey is interesting because that question about who caused the Holocaust was an open-ended one where surveillants could give multiple answers, among them the Nazis, Adolf Hitler, the Jews was among those answers. And then in the next question, they ask who were the victims of the Holocaust. And the majority of respondents in that question did say the Jews among, you know, members of the homosexual community, the Roma, etc. But there's some overlap in the New York findings. They add up to 102% if you count those who say the Jews were at fault and those who say that the Jews were the victims. So the question, I'm curious to see if you go back to those people and you were to have asked them again after asking the victim question who you think was responsible for the Holocaust, whether their answer would stay the same. It's an interesting survey, and I just want to point out, though, that though the focus has been on the fact that it's millennials and Gen Xers who are not really aware of the Holocaust, and as Nancy rightly points out, part of that is because of this lack of firsthand connection to people who survived it, the stats aren't too much different for America as a whole. In January, Pew put out issued results of a survey about the Holocaust, where they found that about 55% of Americans did not know that 6 million Jews died during the Holocaust. They didn't get that number exactly right. So it is a problem that needs to be addressed with the youth and with Holocaust education moving forward. But it's also not just these two generations. It's a broader problem in the U.S.
Well, Paul, you know, if you think over the last year or so, there's been a lot of discussion about how many Americans are undereducated about the history of slavery and racism in this country. How surprised are you that there are so many people who don't know the details of the Holocaust?
Depressingly, I'm not that surprised, but I think one of the real concerns is it's not just a matter of a lack of education. One of the other stats that was thrown up was that 56% of the respondents said they'd seen Nazi symbols on their social media platforms, and over half, or nearly half, had seen Holocaust denial material on the social media. So it's not just that people are uneducated or that the stories of the people that survived the Holocaust are dying out. It's that there is a very, very concerted campaign to disinform people, to deny the Holocaust. And the fact that, you know, half of these people are coming across Nazi symbols on their social media accounts is incredibly alarming. And as we know, most of the people that are spending most of their time on social media accounts are young people. And if they're being bombarded with this stuff, it's worse than them not being educated. It's them being educated badly and disinformed and making the problem much, much worse. I suspect the older population is due to, you know, a lack of education. What we're seeing with the younger generation is them being deliberately misinformed about what happened.
We got this email from Nancy who says, this is really disturbing. Maybe the film Night and Fog or similar films should be shown in high school as part of the regular curriculum. Well, moving on, in late August, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, Japan's longest-serving prime minister, announced his resignation, citing his health struggle with ulcerative colitis. This week, his replacement was announced, Yoshihide Suga. He's a close ally of Abe's, known as the fixer and right-hand man. Nancy, tell us more about who he is and how he came to power.
Well, it's very interesting because so many leaders in Japan come from political families, and this was someone who had largely been behind the scenes for the past 8 years, as you mentioned, as Abe's right-hand man. And so this week we started to learn about someone who had an unconventional rise through Japanese politics. He's the son of a strawberry farmer and a school teacher, and chose his college because it was the cheapest, and worked his way as a cardboard factory worker. He had served on the representatives for a period and steadily rose through the ranks to become the chief cabinet secretary for Prime Minister Abe, which meant that he was not only sort of the top chief of staff, but sometimes press spokesman. And so he was called the Iron Wall by some Japanese journalists because of his unwillingness to answer hard questions. But we don't know much in terms of his vision outside of through the eyes of Abe, because that's how he has operated. And his rise to the premiership was not based on a coalition or a faction that he had built around them, but sort of the absence of consensus around others. And so it's interesting. He has a very interesting history, and how he sort of frames his term going forward in some ways remains to be seen. So far, he has sort of tied himself to continuing some of the work of Abe. But I think there's an argument to be made that we're entering this rare period of political uncertainty. He has a 50% approval rating now, but whether he's able to hold on to that and develop his own sort of identity and brand and personality, having been that sort of the tough guy behind the scenes, working and understanding the machinery of Japan's bureaucracy better than most, can he translate that into a political figure, one who resonates with the Japanese people and can continue some of the relationships and with the U.S. and others that Abe was able to do?
Well, Paul, I'm curious how much his reception is being impacted by Prime Minister Abe. His approval rating was plummeting before he stepped down.
Yes, but what Shinzo Abe really did bring to Japan was a sense of stability. I mean, before he came along, the Japanese changed their prime ministers often as they changed their shirts. I mean, it was ridiculous. No one ever knew who was going to be prime minister and how long they were going to stay on for. So what Shinzo Abe did was bring stability to Japanese politics and allow it to try and change and reform what was an incredibly sort of ossified, bureaucratic way of running a government. Now, what we've got now with the new man is the man who was in charge of the bureaucracy. Now, he knows where all the bodies are buried. He knows which levers to pull to basically get himself the position that he's got. And he's a very hardworking man, etc. But he's a terrible talker and he's not a very good campaigner. And so the question will be, he may be the safe choice for the Japanese bureaucracy, and he may be the only person everyone can kind of agree that they want, but can he win elections? Can he actually inspire the Japanese people to kind of do bigger and better things? Because they've been knocked sideways by COVID and the economic impacts on that. So he's untested in the public forum. And that's what's going to be really interesting, watching to see if he can evolve into a proper politician rather than just a grey bureaucrat.
Well, Nancy, how quickly does that have to happen for him to be successful in this role?
Well, I mean, as Paul notes, because of the recent history before Abe, that is, where you had a rapid change, one has to imagine that the clock is ticking given that past history, and also given the enormity of the problem around COVID and aging population. One gets the sense that there's a desire to see his personality, his ability to form his own platform rather quickly, that there won't be a lot of time given because he's not seen as somebody who is transformational. He is seen as someone who was born out of not having a strong, viable alternative to his premiership. And so I imagine that the clock is ticking, and that all that skepticism in terms of his ability to be a politician puts a lot of pressure on him to undo that perception.
Well, and Paul, who do you think is keeping the most critical eye on him politically? People who may be looking for their own opportunity to step into leadership.
Well, it's all the thing about Japanese politics is it's incredibly murky. So no one put their hand up this time because they didn't want to be shot down. So they're all basically waiting in the wind. There is no clear person to take over from Shinzo Abe, which is why they've ended up with the grey man of Japanese politics. But there will be people waiting beneath the surface, a little like sort of crocodiles, waiting to see him slip. And if he slips, they will go in for the kill and they will try and take the role themselves. Because what Shinzo Abe has done has shown that if you can get to that role and you can hang on for quite some time and be quite transformational. So in the past, you could kind of wait for your turn to come around to be prime minister because you knew it would be coming around again in about 18 months' time, if not sooner. This Shinzo Abe has created a sense of there is a long-term career in being a prime minister. And so they want to pick the right moment. So they're all beneath the surface at the moment, waiting to see if this man trips up.
Well, leading opposition figure Alexei Navalny regained his consciousness this week. The Russian had been in a medically induced coma since being poisoned by a nerve agent last month. Navalny fell ill on a flight back to Russia, but reports from his team say that traces of poison were found on a water bottle in his hotel room in Siberia. Nancy, Putin previously said that he sees no reason to blame the Russian state for the attack or to launch a criminal probe into the matter. But Navalny says he plans to return to Russia. What's the thinking here?
Well, what's interesting is his team thought that there was reason to be suspicious because when he got sick on the plane, they immediately went to his room and got those water bottles, got any evidence to bring with him to Germany where he was then diagnosed. And so I think it speaks to how much there was an anticipation that he would be under threat of some kind. And so I think there's a lot of reason to believe that he continues to pose that threat. Remember, he was in Siberia for local elections at the time, and two of those candidates that he supported actually won. And so, and they didn't win they were overtly anti-Kremlin candidates. And so I think he poses a real threat because he has been the most prominent. He uses social media and other platforms in a way that others haven't. And so while Russia can say that they're going to welcome him, I think there's reason to believe that they will he will continue to be targeted, and his survival of this has not only sort of complicated Russia's internal politics, but has really created tension between Russia and the European Union. And so there was all sorts of issues around not only the circumstances of his poisoning, but the ability to identify Russia and his subsequent survival.
Does his survival provide him with a veneer of protection if he chooses to return to Russia?
I mean, that's a good question. One could argue that this whole circumstance has really elevated his platform and his influence. And so while that might be the case, that you could argue that there's some level of protection, at least in the short term, I think over long term, he presents a real threat, and that will supersede, I think, any sort of decision if you're Russia. I guess it really depends on how much he's able to impact elections going forward, and we have a couple coming up in the next year.
Well, Paul, Germany has reached out to the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons for help investigating the alleged poisoning. Moscow also contacted the organization, but according to a Russian foreign ministry spokeswoman, the OPCW said that requests should be sent to Berlin. What is Germany's role in all of this?
Well, Germany has basically kind of accepted this man, and they are looking into working out what happened with him. There are a lot of tensions within the German-Russian relationship, going back, as we know, many, many decades. This has also caused some problems for Angela Merkel, because she was pushing for a big gas pipeline deal with Russia, and now she's being encouraged to kind of pull out of those sort of things. So, you know, Germany is the most powerful, most politically important country in Europe. And so when you have the most important political country in Europe up against the biggest influencer outside of Europe, i.e. Russia, you have got a tense relationship. And the Europeans have mishandled, frankly, Russia's recent rise. They began to think after the end of the Cold War that Russia was weak, that they could push forward towards its borders by encouraging more of the once satellite states to come into the EU. And eventually Russia said no. And Europe has shown that it can't actually do very much when Russia says no. So we're in a kind of diplomatic dance at the moment. Germany is pretty angry about what's going on, but there's no move anywhere to really take any action against Russia. There's not the unity to do that. So the relationship is tense. It probably won't get any better. It may not get any worse.
Well, the OPCW is expected to release its results as soon as calls for sanctions grow. And French President Emmanuel Macron, on a phone call with Putin this week, demanded that all light be shed without delay on the circumstances and responsibilities of this attempted assassination. That's a quote there. Hayes, how much does this matter to Vladimir Putin? How much attention is he paying to this investigation?
I mean, on the one hand, it will be quite damning if the OPCW does come back and says, yes, we agree with the German scientists who have determined that it was Novichok that was used against Navalny, this Soviet-age poison that we saw used against the Skripals in the United Kingdom. It would be extremely damning for Putin on the international stage to be pointed at again by the international community saying, yes, you did this, you poisoned this man. But on the reverse side, like much like Paul said, there's not really much Europe can do about it at this point. I mean, Vladimir Putin is pretty comfortable right now. He has won the ability to stay in office for years to come. He is, even if he faces opposition from Navalny out in Siberia right now and in other, like, more local elections, there's no real evidence that the condemnation of the international community will have an effect on how he governs Russia. So if I'm Putin, I see this as, we'll see what happens. I'm not very concerned.
Okay, now this next bit of news is potentially big. So if you've had a long week, maybe you're feeling like the tired kid in the back of the class, well, sit up for a moment and pay attention to this.
What we think we found is phosphine gas in the atmosphere of Venus. Now, on a rocky planet like the Earth, phosphine is a rare gas, and it's mainly the result of life. So it's what we call a biosignature. Now, on the Earth, phosphine is caused by human activity, so through industry, or through microorganisms or microbes. And so finding a gas like this on Venus is really exciting.
That's Emily Drawback Maunder speaking to the BBC earlier this week. She works at the Royal Greenwich Observatory in London. And she matters because she's the co-author of a recent discovery of phosphine in the clouds of Venus. And as one of the brightest objects in the night sky, scientists now have reasons to believe they have found signs of life. Hayes, why were scientists looking or overlooking Venus in their research for so long?
Well, because for the longest time before, say, the late 1960s, in the imaginations of humans, Venus was a potential for being another Earth, Earth twin. It's about the same size as Earth. It's closer to the sun than Mars is. And for the longest time, people pictured, like, Venusian swamplands or oceans just teeming with life. But then in the 60s, Mariner 2 flew by Venus and got data that showed that, no, the surface of Venus is about 800 degrees Fahrenheit. So kind of ruled it out as having any chance. A little toasty. So we ruled it out as having any chance of supporting life as we know it. Now, why this is exciting, I will say, is because, like she just said, the fact is that phosphine on Earth, extremely rare. You only find it from anaerobic bacteria that dwell, like, in places with low oxygen, like in our stomachs or in the stomachs of other animals, or it's made through manufacturing. It was used as a chemical weapon back in World War I because it smells terrible. But the idea is that if this is produced in the atmosphere of Venus, which is much cooler than the surface, there is a possibility that there's somehow life up there. But I will say that it's not a guarantee. There's no guarantee that the phosphine is even there. There's a chance that the data won't be able to be replicated if we do another flyby of Venus. There could be a chance that it's not actually, that there is a process to make phosphine that we're just not aware of yet. But it is exciting. I will not stomp on that. It is exciting that we found this stuff in Venus.
Nancy, do you think this could have an impact on how we search for life on other planets going forward?
Well, I think in some ways it already has. NASA's talked about it's coming up with its future plans, looking at researching Venus a little bit more. And the head of Russia's government space agency already claimed it a Russia planet. So there's been very Earth-like responses and branding and claiming already happening ahead of, as Hayes points out, definitive proof of life on Venus.
Hayes, I have to ask you, because you made a point of emphasizing the fact that phosphine smells terrible. How do you know?
I luckily have not had firsthand experience with phosphine. I know this through reading up on all this because when it first When the push alerts first started, I was as fascinated as everyone, but I also was skeptical because it's very easy to take these kind of studies, especially about astronomy and about the potential for life on other planets, and people get excited. People get really hyped up about it. So I wanted to figure out, what is this stuff that they found on Venus and why is it so interesting? So thankfully, no real experience with it firsthand here.
Well, news a little closer to home this week from the Caribbean island nation of Barbados. Its prime minister says the country will remove Queen Elizabeth as their official head of state and plans to become a republic. Barbados gained independence in 1966, but has remained a constitutional monarchy. Paul, why did Barbados decide to end these colonial ties now?
Well, there's been a lot of talk about doing this for many, many years, and it does rather feel that perhaps the kind of Black Lives Matter, the movement that's gone around the world, has nudged it a little bit forward. It did talk about kind of walking away from its kind of colonial history. So I think this is a country that's been thinking about it for a very long time, and in the present climate, it's felt to them that now is the time to do it. And the Queen has said it's entirely up to them if that's the way they want to do it. There's every possibility that they would stay within the Commonwealth, which is countries that have been once were part of the colonial rule of the UK or part of the Empire and have gone their own way, but are still kind of tied to the country in terms of trade and history, etc. So it's not that surprising. The timing is perhaps a little bit more surprising, but it does seem to be linked to the kind of rethinking of countries and people's histories around the world. But it seems, you know, an amicable split, if you like.
Well, Barbados is one of the wealthiest and most populated Caribbean countries. What kind of impact economically could this have on them if they make this decision to move forward?
I don't think it'll have a massive economic impact. I mean, as you say, it makes its money out of tourism. I can't see anyone sort of taking umbrage in the UK about the fact that the Queen's no longer the head of state. So I think it's basically it's a young country saying we're ready to kind of stand on our own two feet and, you know, reflect a more modern side of ourselves. So I think it will be relatively uncontroversial. Certainly, I don't think it'll impact on trade relations or diplomatic relations with the UK. I think it's just a kind of, you know, a slow ebbing change of history.
And functionally, is this a quick process or will it take some time?
Well, they just have to kind of get the mechanics in place. So once they decide that they're actually going to do it, they'll have to kind of unpick some of their laws will be kind of related to the head of state and they'll have to be replaced. They'll have to elect a president to take over those rules. So they've got a head of state that things can be referred to. So that will take a little bit of time, but it's not insurmountable. It's been done before in the region. And so I guess, you know, it's hard to see them not going ahead with it because, you know, they've made the announcement. There's been no real pushback from anyone. I think it will take a few years, but they'll get there in the end.
Well, earlier in the show, I mentioned that the number of global COVID cases now top 30 million. The U.S., India, and Brazil have the highest totals, but large parts of Europe are also now struggling with a second wave. Paul, what's going on in the U.K. right now?
Well, we are in a little bit of trouble, it would seem, because the numbers have been rising again. Certain parts of the country are in a kind of regional lockdown. There has been some talk that the country might need to go into a full lockdown, but the Prime Minister Boris Johnson has said he really doesn't want to do that because of the economic impact on the country. There's also been some kind of pushback against what they called the Rule of Six, which came in earlier this week, which basically says you cannot have more than six people together, although there are some exceptions. And there's a fantastic letter to the Financial Times today, which says, if I understand the UK government's rule of six correctly, it is illegal for seven children to feed ducks, but legal for 30 men to shoot them. Which is the case. There's been an exemption put into the rules to allow hunting parties to go around in groups of 30 if they're socially distant. So there is not a united front in the UK at the moment about how to tackle the COVID virus, either politically or within the people of the United Kingdom.
Well, and when we talk about an uptick in cases, what's being pointed at as the cause of that? Is it people, you know, spending more time in large groups, maybe people not wearing masks as much?
Well, a colleague of mine has just come over from the UK into Washington and was quite surprised at the level of mask wearing that is going on in DC. Now, I know it varies around the country, but in the UK it has been much more sporadic, I think, than other parts of the world. But it's also, like many other parts of the world, due to young people getting together and spreading the virus. And at the moment, most of those infections are within young people. But what's worrying the government is that will transfer into the older population. We're moving into the flu season, which always puts the the National Health Service in the UK under immense strain. What they don't want to do is have the same problems they had earlier this year, starting again with the older generation. Now, last time around, it happened at the tail end of the flu season. This time around, they're worried about it happening right at the beginning. So 5 months of flu season on top of coronavirus. And that's what they're trying to avoid with this kind of regional lockdowns.
How do schools play into this? Are they back in person in the UK?
They are. They are back to school. And I think there's been a lot of call from people in the UK to basically say, look, the school should be the priority. If we have to close down some of the pubs and the bars and the gyms, we need to keep the schools open. The government certainly wants to do that because it recognises if people have their children at home, they're less likely to be going to work. So there's been a big debate in the UK about the right way to do it. But schools do seem to be the priority for people. Although if we see another escalation, there is talk of them doing a 2-week lockdown again over the school half term in October. But there's a lot of pushback against that.
And how much is there a sense of urgency that something needs to happen quickly to avoid a wider spread of the virus?
There's a huge sense of urgency because, as I say, the National Health Service survived last time around. But there's a great deal of worry that when the flu season comes, it will put a massive strain if it's combined with COVID. So you've got a lot of young people that have gone back to school, they've gone back to university, and now they're kind of incubating what many people fear will be a surge. And so the government does feel like it's running up against the clock, and it's trying to get people in the UK to kind of go along with them. But there's been some hiccups, and this, as I say, this rule about you can't have more than 7 people feed a duck, but you can shoot them in groups of 30, is an illustration of how there is division within society about how to tackle it, and the government hasn't quite got its messaging right yet, I don't think.
Well, earlier today, Reuters said Taiwan was forced to scramble its fighter jets as 18 Chinese aircraft buzzed the island, crossing the sensitive midline of the Taiwan Strait. This all took place at a time when a senior U.S. official is holding talks in Taipei. Nancy, help us understand what's going on.
Sure. Just a little bit of background. Up until the Trump administration, the U.S. and Taiwan were quite furtive in terms of discussing things like military sales. There was rarely a high-level visit by a U.S. official because the idea was to support Taiwan but not aggravate China. And as we've seen under the Trump administration, they've been much more aggressive and overt in terms of its challenges and confrontations with China. And one of the places that this is playing out is in Taiwan. We've seen a series of military weapon sales, most recently 66 F-16s, and now talk about drones and other smaller types of equipment being sold by the United States to Taiwan. And the response has been a more aggressive military posture in the region. And so in this case, China said that it was conducting military drills near the Taiwan Strait. They flew, as you mentioned, 18 aircraft nearby. It was a very aggressive and one of the more aggressive moves we've seen by them, leading Taiwan to scramble its fighter jet. At the same time, the U.S. Undersecretary for Economic Affairs just arrived in Taipei, and one would argue that one reason China was doing this was to sort of signal its frustration with these overt moves by the United States to sort of poke at China, if you will. We saw something smaller but similar when the Secretary of Health and Human Services was in Taipei last month. And so, and I bring a military eye to this, my own sort of, as I'm watching, is militarily, these kinds of things can lead to unintended consequences because one mistake by one pilot or one soldier can lead to a kind of understanding where this sort of tit-for-tat demonstration of force, demonstration of aggravation can lead to second and third order effects that are unintended.
Well, earlier, the Commerce Department announced it will ban U.S. business transaction with the Chinese-owned social apps WeChat and TikTok starting Sunday. Hayes, if you already have the app, are you impacted by this move?
Not yet. Well, let's clarify. It's technically two things that are being being affected right now. There's TikTok, and there's also WeChat, which is also a Chinese-owned company. WeChat immediately. That is, you are no longer able to really access that, according to the U.S. Commerce Department. TikTok, you have some time. You have until November 12th, if you already have the app downloaded, or if you download it by Sunday, to keep watching videos, to keep using it, to keep uploading. After that, though, you will not be able to access videos. You will not be able to access the data that TikTok stores. You will not be able to access those videos. So, but that comes with the caveat that is, if TikTok does not come to a decision that meets the Trump administration standards that they put out in the executive order that Trump signed, demanding that TikTok be spun off from ByteDance, the Chinese company that owns it, and be owned by, ideally, a U.S. company. Now, the deal with Oracle earlier this week, for a second there, it looked like TikTok might make it through this, still able to operate in the U.S., but that once the details started to come out, that it wasn't really a sale so much as a partnership, that began to become in doubt, especially since the commission in the U.S. that would have had to approve the deal, there was no way it could have gotten done by the time the deadline that the administration set came up. So if you haven't downloaded TikTok yet, I'm pretty sure we're about to see a spike in downloads. Whether or not it'll actually be saved by November 12th, that's up in the air right now.
Paul, quickly, your reaction to this move by the White House.
Look, I think it's going to be quite dramatic for people who are Chinese kind of expatriates, because you know, WeChat is basically the whole kind of social media ecosphere for China. So it's going to be really, really difficult. People communicate with their families. They send money to their families. It's the framework for keeping in contact with people back home. So I think it will have a big impact, not just on people in China, but the Chinese diaspora around the world.
That's Paul Danahar, Washington Bureau Chief for the BBC. He's also the author of The New Middle East, The World After the Arab Spring. Also with us, Nancy Youssef, National Security Reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and Hayes Brown, host of the podcast News O'Clock at BuzzFeed. Thanks to you all. 1A's senior producer is Paige Osborne, and our podcast is produced by Matthew Simonson. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks so much for listening, and let's talk again soon. This is 1A.